The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
All right, so we got John Teller here. John and I have been knowing each other probably 6-7 years. He did a Trojan horse program back in the day in Orange County. Was David DeRobertis at that one?
Yeah.
Oh, because he came to one of them in Orange County.
No, I don't think so.
Anyways, John works over at the Wilshire Law Firm for as long as I've known him, but tries quite a few cases. How many trials have you done so far? How old are you, John? You're pretty young.
I'm 37.
37.
Yeah, I've done about 12 trials and I think like 6 or 7 arbitrations.
You're still kind of new to the game, but obviously accomplishing quite a bit here. So tell us, you're from Canada originally, is that right?
Originally from Toronto, Canada.
And when did you move to the States?
I went to law school in New York, and that's what ultimately brought me out to LA because I met a girl out in New York and couldn't convince her to move to the freezing cold north, so she brought me out to La La Land.
So tell us about, you got married, but when did you decide that you really wanted to be a trial lawyer? And I ask this because there's a lot of commitment to really going to trial. Your wife has to get on board because you're going to disappear for a week or a month at a time as you're focused on your trials.
It's true. I don't think my wife is fully on board yet, so I'm still working on that. I always get a lot of grief when trial starts, but I started off actually on the defense side in my career. I really didn't know I wanted to be a trial lawyer up front, like in law school. I had no idea. I did take like a trial advocacy class that I really, really enjoyed. And then when I got to experience really my first trial, and I got lucky, it was one of my first jobs, like right out of the gate. When I joined Dana Fox at Lewis Brisbois, who's like a well-known defense trial lawyer, I got to go to Fresno to watch a trial. I didn't get to do anything. I just got to watch and report every day as to what was going on and what my general thoughts were. And that was like the coolest thing ever. It felt like real TV. And right then I knew, I was like, all right, I definitely want to do this.
And were you watching Dana?
Actually, it wasn't in Dana. That's what's so funny. It was, we were like representing the backup umbrella insurance carrier. So Dana's like, oh, you go up there and watch and report. So that's where I got to experience it. And then thereafter, I got to experience a trial with Dana, and that was, again, also amazing. And one nice thing about working with Dana is he's always up against, like, the best plaintiff trial attorneys. Panish, I hate to say his name now, you know, Girardi at the time, many years back, he was really good. There was that Dodger Stowe case, if everybody remembers, at Dodger Stadium. Seeing all the best plaintiff attorneys out there, you know, Dordick, Simon, all these guys, was an amazing experience.
And while you were on the defense?
While I was on the defense.
And so you've been on the plaintiff side for how many years now?
And now I've been on the plaintiff side for about 7 years, maybe 8 years.
And how do you think that time you spent on the defense? How many years did you spend on the defense?
I was just under 5 years.
And how do you think those 5 years helped you become the trial lawyer you are today?
Couldn't ask for a better experience. Learning how the defense thinks, how they operate, how they prepare for trial, and then now using those skills against them, figuring out the strategy, how going in knowing what they're going to be doing, incredible experience. I highly recommend, in fact, like kids in law school ask me, I want to go into litigation, but I don't know what to do. That's actually really one of my first, you know, recommendations is try to get a job on the defense side first so you can learn how they operate, how they think, how they evaluate cases, and then eventually move over to the plaintiff side, I think is the best strategy.
Right. And then they can learn, too, that they like to be a slave or not. It says some people like to be slaves and just want to bill hours, 12 hours a day. And that's where they get the pat on the back. The more hours, it doesn't matter what they do in those hours. You just have to bill them.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody's actually checking. It doesn't really matter. There's not a real client there. It's just some mega corporation. So some people like that stuff. I have trouble understanding how somebody could enjoy that. But there are people because they do it for years and endless amount of time.
There's no doubt that's one thing I don't miss at all is the billable hour requirements. That is, oh, man, thank God that's done with.
I can only imagine. So you talked about learning how to get ready for trial and the defense. But let's talk about, you know, those 30 days before trial. You got a trial on the horizon. What is your process the month before so that you get ready and you're prepared to, you know, stand up?
So first off, I'm big on figuring out who my like best witnesses are. And usually those are going to be friends and family witnesses, coworkers, and maybe a neighbor or a pastor. So I'm really big into finding who those people are and interviewing them and having a discussion as to what they know, and then ranking kind of 1 to 5, who are going to be the best ones? Because some judges will only allow you to call like 1 to 3 of those types of people. So I'm really big into that. Once I know who my key players are, big on preparing opening slides and reworking opening slides multiple times before trial. And then I'm big on cross-examination of the defense. So I really look everywhere and anywhere for transcripts of defense experts. That's another big thing I'm doing. And then, of course, you know, reading all the depositions in the case and figuring out, hey, like, what are the key testimony, what's out there, and what motion in limine I can bring. That's usually, other than obviously taking a bunch of expert depots also at the same time and organizing things, it's a big job. There's a lot to make sure that all the key things are coming together to put on the full display at trial. You know, making sure your animations are ready, your exhibits, you know, everything. It's a big task.
And you typically have at least, what, one associate with you in trial?
Yeah, usually have one associate with me. So he's also helping he or she getting the exhibits ready, making sure we have everything, talking to these people, that type of stuff, making sure we have a focus group ready. There's so much that goes into just one trial. And usually I'm preparing for multiple trials at once. I mean, if you look at my office, I've got like rows of boxes here because we're prepping for 3 trials all at the same time right now. So it's a little bit hectic, but we have a great team. The paralegals are very helpful and make it all happen.
All right. Well, let's talk about, you know, you mentioned doing focus groups ahead of time. What is your philosophy on focus groups and the usefulness of them all and what you're trying to accomplish with them?
Yeah, so definitely every case is different, obviously. There's a difference between like a rear-end no liability crash compared to a major liability dispute. So if it's a major liability dispute, I definitely want to figure out how I can persuade a potential jury how to get over those really bad issues. So some focus groups, again, on liability cases, it's going to be all liability. That's all I'm focusing on. The major issues, want to know what your average person thinks about the issue and what information they would want to know to get over that issue. If I can even get over it, hopefully I can. Or at least I know going into trial, hey, maybe this is not the best case to try and maybe I should settle. But usually that's the liability aspect of it. And then damages, again, walking through the issues, what the defense is going to present in terms of how they're going to always try to suggest, you know, surgery wasn't necessary or the value of the case is much lower than we think it is. So sometimes it's just about talking about money and what people think the value is of these injuries and the traumatic effect it is on that person's life.
Well, I know recently at one of your recent trials that you used John Campbell, you did a big data focus group. So tell us about the decision to do that and how it affected your presentation in that particular case.
Yeah, so huge credit to him. If I could do that on every single trial, I would 100% recommend it. So if you have a really, really strong case and you really believe in it and you want to put the money behind it, you should do that. Honestly, they're not cheap. If you have just like a relatively small epidural case or, you know, major liability case that you are very concerned about, maybe it's not in the budget. But if it is in the budget, I highly, highly recommend it, because part of that, the evaluation there was really we were trying to evaluate what number makes the most sense to ask for in terms of the damages. What would your average person feel comfortable giving? And the data showed that, you know, if you ask for too much, that's a problem. And if you ask for too little, that's also a problem. So he really helped me figure out, you know, what the right range was to ask for on that particular case, and obviously worked out great. Kind of worked out exactly how the data suggested.
So give us some more details of that case. What kind of case was it? Why was it this particular case? You're thinking, okay, I'm going to spend that 20, 25, 30, I don't know how much it is, but I know it's in that range, depending on the size of the group. I'm going to spend that 25 grand and I'm going to get the information. So what was the push that you decided to do that?
Yeah, so it was a rear end collision. Liability wasn't disputed. So I already know I'm going in, I'm a winner, right? So that's already a great fact. And my client had a fusion surgery and then a spinal cord stimulator surgery. And if you look at the jury verdicts out there on any of those websites, there's not that many verdicts out there with a fusion and a spinal cord stimulator surgery in terms of like data that's out there, especially for asking for significant money in California. I can't speak to other states. So I wanted to know, like, I truly believed in my client. I really liked him. I thought he was great. His family present really, really genuine. I really believed in the case, and I believed, you know, that this was a huge case in terms of the loss that they suffered. So then it's, you start wondering, hey, well, is that, you know, worth $5 million? Is that worth $10 million? Is that worth $25 million? Is that worth $50 million or $100 million? That's part of our job, is to be able to convey what the value of the damages are and feel confident about it. You know, you can't go into trial and be like, $80 million. I don't know. What do you guys think? Right. You know, the jury's going to laugh at you. So I really wanted to get hands-on experience. And yeah, you can do a focus group with 12 people at your office. And I did that. And that's very valuable. But getting like 300 people from John Campbell's study, all looking at this, and it's really detailed, like they do a video of your client, they really hear both sides of the case. I think it's very objective how he does it. He presents the defense side very well. And we tested different ranges, including, of course, the facts of the case. And he identified issues with the case where things that potential jurors didn't like. And then again, where that sweet spot was in terms of asking for the money in terms of the value of the loss.
In this particular case, what did the data show?
The data showed that we should ask for in the range of, I believe, 25 to 35 million. And that's ultimately exactly what I asked for. And that's ultimately exactly what we got. We ended up with a $35 million verdict, which was really cool. And the right verdict. That's what the data showed. And that's what the jury said. So it was right on.
And I assume, is that your biggest verdict to date?
That is my biggest verdict to date. Yep.
That must have been pretty exciting to cross the threshold into eight-figure land, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Because so much of this trial lawyering is what's going on between the trial, you know, your own ears, in your own mind, your belief in yourself. Am I that guy? And I've seen a trend when somebody hits their first eight-figure case, changes how they value things and, you know, honestly, how the defense values them too. Because I assume that you probably saw some uptick in your settlements and other values beyond just this verdict that are the intangibles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. 100%. It really helps you with all your other cases, of course, resolving them. But then also, again, you dissect. That's one of the things I learned from you, is always dissecting your trials and what you've done before. And, you know, thank God I had the experience of getting a couple seven-figure verdicts. And what I believe is what you need to do a little bit differently to get to that eight-figure threshold. And thankfully, you know, I've got another eight-figure verdict since then as well. So
which one was that?
That was this past February 2023 in Van Nuys. I got just under a $14 million verdict, which turned into an $18 million judgment. So that was pretty cool too.
And what kind of case was that?
That was a vehicle versus motorcycle case. Our client actually did not have surgery yet. He was recommended a spine surgery, and he also injured his testicles. And that was a big part of the case, is the testicle injury.
Those testicles are valuable, especially if you don't have kids yet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You really need those little fellas down there. That makes perfect sense. All right. And so actually, we need to do case analysis on those two verdicts and whichever ones you want. So don't be so lazy. You know,
I'm so busy, but
whatever. Say it to the hand. All right. So let's talk about voir dire. So clearly, you've been working on your various trial skills. So when it comes to voir dire, tell us about your approach to it.
Sure. So again, going back to the money and having confidence in the money, you have to have confidence and be able to talk about money. If you don't know how to talk to strangers about money, then that's a major problem in my mind. So, you know, again, that's what focus groups are for, is to experience talking to strangers and feeling comfortable about money and what it means to lose something valuable and appraising that, you know?
Okay, so let's pretend like I'm a juror and you just said, you know, you're just going to broach your money voir dire. So talk to us about how you talk about money with jurors, because a lot of people, like you said, have trouble doing it. And if they have some reference, it's easier for a Panish or a Rowley who got $1 billion you know, like, oh, it's not about the money. I'm like, okay, you have $1 billion. For the rest of us are still on our way. It's kind of about the money. So tell us how you talk to the jury about money.
So generally I start off with, this is going to be your job at the end of the day, is you're ultimately going to be appraising the value of the loss to my client, you know, the value of health and quality of life. And at the end of the day on the verdict form, you're going to have to write down a number for that. So I need to know from you, are you the type of person that can value that? And that's why we kind of have the scales of justice, use that as an analogy. And I say, hey, can you value the quality of life? Every single day in our lives, we are valuing things when we buy them, whether you're going to the grocery store, whether you're going to buy a new car or a new house, you're valuating, you're, you know, appraising things. So as you heard, we're going to be asked, usually in mini opening, I already tell them I'm going to be asking for millions of dollars. Sometimes I give them an exact figure or a range, like I'm going to be asking for 20 to 30 million. You heard about that. Do you think you can value the loss of life, the quality of life and health for millions and millions of dollars? And usually that really obviously stirs up a huge conversation. And then we just jump from juror to juror and getting that conversation going. I usually want to know, do they feel like they have a maximum in their mind? Like, hey, no matter what, I can't get over X amount, cause some jurors will say, like, no matter what, I won't give you $1 million. I don't care if your client lost all their limbs, right? So I need to know that going in on my spine surgery case where my guy has all his limbs. If you're not going over $1 million, that's a huge problem for me. Right? So you got to know where, it's really more about where people stand in terms of, can they put a value of millions of dollars on the loss of quality of life? That's really ultimately what I need to know. And then I also do, of what you're also big on, future medical expenses too. Because generally speaking, the future medical expenses also are going to be high, usually in the millions of dollars. If it's a spine surgery case with multiple surgeries going to be needed in the future. And I think people don't spend enough time on that issue as well. I think you need people that are willing to evaluate what the medical cost is going to be in the future. So I spend time on that as well.
When you first stand up, what is your opening move, stick to get that connection, you know, get that conversation going? Because it seems like you just can't jump into the biases or the money before you have some preliminary chit chat. Like, so what's yours, you know, your preliminary stuff?
Yeah, so I'll admit I take this directly from Gary Dornick, because he's one of the best trial lawyers out there, is I ask them right off the bat, who's excited to be here? You know, I want to know which jurors want to be part of this process. And then I just ask the opposite question, who's really excited to get out of here and who doesn't want to be here? And you'll get a lot of hands on that too. So if nobody's excited to be there, you're definitely going to get people that want to get the hell out of there. And that will stir up the conversation. It'll usually lead to what are people's thoughts about lawsuits in general. So that gets you right into those types of bias questions as well.
I think that's a good start. I mean, because like, who's excited to be here? Because then you have excitement on your face, right? So you're communicating this is a positive thing. Now the opposite, who's not very excited to be here? You still have a positive emotion on your face. You're just using the negative. It's a good starting point. And then how do you talk about, let's say, you know, the burden of proof in, you know, these trials where you're asking for millions of dollars and millions of dollars?
Yeah. So again, the scale's more likely true than not true. And I use the hand movements and the gestures, and I explain that's going to be on every single issue too. If I have multiple issues on a case, I'm actually going to deal with that more likely true than not true burden of proof thing on every single issue, because they might be really good on one thing. Like someone might be really good on the blood alcohol level thing and whether one or two beers is a problem or not, but they might be horrible on a separate issue. Like, you know, that said, I'm okay with you driving with two beers, but your guy's on a bicycle and I freaking hate bicyclists. So you're going to need a lot more than more likely true than not true on that issue. So I want to make sure I hit it on all my issues, not just generally. Because I think generally, if you just ask, hey, can everybody agree that they'll follow the law and more likely true than not true? They're all just going to say yes. So I think you got to really use it towards each of the issues in the case.
So let me back up a second, because in California, in some states, you get this mini opening. So tell us about mini openings, typically what, 2 to 3 minutes? It's pretty short. And the judge lets you just kind of give a preliminary overview of the case. So the jurors know what they're, you know, gives context to the, obviously the rest of the voir dire questions. So what is your philosophy on the mini opening? And do you do it yourself? Or do you have, like, Rex Parris always has somebody else do his mini opening so he can point to that guy thinks it's worth $30 million. Now, that's kind of nuts, but what do you think? Give us your mini opening philosophy.
Yeah, for sure. So I've always done it myself. You know, maybe I'll listen to Rex's idea and try someone else doing it next time. Who knows? But super quick summary of just the general facts, just so they kind of understand what the case is about. Then I talk about my bad facts. You're going to hear X, Y, and Z, what those bad facts are. And then I tell them, at the end of the day, we believe the loss involved in this case is worth, and I usually give a range, $25 to $35 million. If I'm allowed to. There's some judges who I strongly disagree with them on in terms of what the law says, but some judges believe the law says you can't give an exact number, but usually I'm able to persuade a judge to let me say, all right, I'm going to be asking for millions of dollars. So if that's that type of judge, I'll say it like that. I'm going to be asking for millions of dollars at the end of the day.
All right. Let's move on to opening statement. So when do you said like the 30 days before you're working on your opening visual. So give us your philosophy on opening and what you're trying to accomplish.
Sure. So I really believe that's like your best time to talk about all the evidence or what you believe the evidence is going to show, obviously, and really win them over. If you haven't won them over already during voir dire and being the nice guy in the room compared to the guy that's standing up after you. Now, when you're actually talking about the evidence, you want to win the case right there. So I try my best to do exactly that, win the case. It's kind of like a closing argument, but not a closing argument, because obviously there's certain things in opening you can't say. So walk them through the timeline, show them some key exhibits if I can that I think are, wow moments and make the jury on your side. If there's an animation, sometimes showing them the animations, photos of our clients, them before the crash with family and friends. And then again, talking about what that loss is worth and how long the loss has been, how long it's going to be in the future, and what that's going to look like in terms of his yearly life, in terms of both the loss and the medical expenses.
Do you practice your actual opening in front of a focus group prior to delivering it?
Yeah, generally speaking, yes. It depends on the case. Sometimes I'll just do it for people in the office. But again, if there's going to be major issues on the case, then that are going to be liability issues, then yeah, I want to get in front of a focus group with regard to my opening, because I'm constantly changing it also. And then there's judges who, like, you prepared this whole thing for the last 30 days and the judge just like strikes 3/4 of it. You also got to be ready for that too. So I try to practice at least once without it as well, just in case I'm not allowed to use a PowerPoint at all. And that's happened to me before. So ever since that experience, that's when I practice it, because that was quite the shocking event. Like, we're ready to open. Okay, can I put on my PowerPoint slides? No, Mr. Teller, you can't. What? And that was an experience that was fun. So now I practice without a PowerPoint, just in case you get a judge that stops you from using one.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about direct examination, because that's often a challenging part for trial for a lot of people. They're much more comfortable on cross, or I don't know. So direct, and we're going to break it into a few different areas. We're going to direct of experts, direct of the plaintiff, and direct of before and after witnesses. And then I want to talk about redirect. So what is your direct of experts? What are your insights on it, things that you do that you think, hey, this really helps me get the medical story out so the jury understands it?
So I do believe in the psychology that generally jurors have like a 10 to 20 minutes attention span, and then they start fading out. So with that said, I'm usually trying to get to my most important things 10 to 20 minutes in. Sometimes I might have a expert on the stand for an hour because I need to, just for purpose of getting evidence in and making sure I hit all the standards, but I'm hitting the most important stuff first, so I get the jurors' attention on that stuff. Right at the get, I go through their qualifications. I think that's really important, so they think that this person is important and has some stature. But I don't like overly go over the qualifications. I think some attorneys I've seen, and even some defense attorneys, it's like 20 minutes of qualification. It's like, all right, we get the point. He's qualified. Move on. So I think out of the gate qualifications, and then you know, let's say it's a spine surgery, I right away say, you know, okay, we understand that there's a spine surgery involved. Let's go right into the spine surgery. If there's an animation, I want to play the animation and then walk through the surgery. You know, obviously ask them if the surgery was reasonable and necessary, do the injuries, and then walk backwards and then be like, all right, let's go from the beginning of this collision up until the point of surgery. But I want to hit the big ticket item because it's usually the surgery that's in dispute. I want to hit that right out of the gate. If sticking with medical experts, usually I want to go through the MRI, the actual MRI, like pull up the films and let the doctor walk the jury through the MRIs. I think a lot of people don't do that. And I think that's a huge mistake because, again, usually that's a big part of the dispute. And then, you know, medical expenses, if the expert's going to talk about medical expenses, obviously cover that. Future medical expenses, covering that, and what type of future treatment is going to be needed. That's a medical expert.
All right. And then the defense crosses them. What is your approach or philosophy on redirect of the experts?
So I think redirect is super important. It's kind of sometimes one of the points where you like win the case because the defense will usually nitpick on like two medical records or one silly thing. When you have like a mountain of evidence that supports your case, they'll pick like one or two things that go against you. So it's your opportunity to point that out to the jury and really walk through, okay, they hit you on this one thing, but does all the evidence, like sometimes I literally pick up like there's four exhibit binders of medical records. I might do all the other exhibit binders, this whole binder of records, do all the other records other than that one little piece of paper from the records. Do they all support the injury is from this crash? And they support that our client had, you know, radiculopathy. So they're pointing to like one date, May 12th, 2020. But yet every other record shows like, you know, that's one example, but is usually like a big moment in front of the jury because they're all like, yeah, that's ridiculous what the defense just did, you know? So redirect is really important if the defense tries to like pull something like that.
Well, aren't they always pulling something like that?
Yeah.
Isn't it their whole job to pull something like that to distract, confuse, refocus on the, you know, the minuscule? I had some defense attorney write me one time. She says, I teach a class for law students. I liked your stuff, but you know, I have some problems with stuff you're doing. Please call me. And I'm like, how about not? How about I don't care? You're a defense lawyer. You should go listen to boring podcasts about preventing nuclear verdicts. I'm here to help facilitate nuclear verdicts, not present them. So not that interested in your opinion.
And then the only other thing I want to say about redirect is to reinforce what his ultimate opinion is. Because if you have a really good defense attorney on the other side, they'll try to, again, manipulate the jury. What I feel like they're trying to do is manipulate the jury and try to make it seem like the expert is on their side all of a sudden. So, and one or two jurors might get mixed up about that. So I want to reiterate, you know, given everything the defense just pointed out, is it still your opinion X? Why is that? And so they reinforce that they do believe the injury and the medical treatment was all caused from this surgery and the reason why. So the jury understands, oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, everything the defense just did was just BS little things trying to poke holes, but not the real conclusions.
And prepping with these experts, do you typically meet with them in person to prep with them for their testimony?
I think it depends on the expert. Obviously, Zoom is super helpful these days, and depending on their experience, you know, some experts have a lot of experience being in court and testifying in trial, and some are like brand new to it and learn what the defense is going to do. So I prep them on, you know, here are the likely questions that are going to come your way, just FYI. I try to talk to them and go over the key issues on the case, or even let's say experts coming in like 2 weeks into trial, sometimes you have to go over what has transpired over the last 2 weeks. You know, maybe some of those bad facts didn't turn out as bad as you thought. Maybe some things didn't even come into evidence. So it's like, hey, do not mention this. The judge ruled that that doesn't come in. You don't want to be your, you don't want to be your expert that opens the box to the bad stuff that I would suck. Sometimes you have to go over that type of stuff as well.
A little coaching here that we don't want to say that, but I can say it. You can't say it. So that'd be used against you. There's a lot of folks that are really big on doing their expert depots by video and just cutting the minimum. And then that way it's like, boom, 12 minutes. Focused presentation on video in the can, not bringing them live, placing it in. You don't have to worry about scheduling. Give us your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'm definitely a big fan of that. Also, like, kind of mixes up the trial for the jurors. Like maybe they're bored of seeing witnesses live. So, everybody likes TV. Oh, we're going to play a video now? Great. Let's watch it. And it's kind of something new and different. So I definitely do that pretty much in every trial. I just literally, like yesterday, sent out a notice of using expert testimony at trials on this case that we were on the wheel for now. We're supposed to be starting trial yesterday, but we're on the wheel. So yeah, definitely love playing video of experts instead of calling them live. It's a great tool. It should be utilized for sure. Both your own experts, and you can even play testimony of the defense experts before they even come in. Sometimes I love doing that, is to play like a 5-minute clip or a 10-minute clip of the defense expert before they even come in for the defense side. So the jury already kind of hears what he has to say and they already feel a certain way towards the defense expert.
So do you play that like defense expert clip sometimes before you call your own expert on that topic? So that way they have a perspective of what the defense is going to do. And then your expert can just be like, that guy's, that's nonsense. You know what I'm saying? That's just so wrong. And so that way it kind of immediately undermines what they're doing.
Yep, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of times I even play some expert clips in my opening statements. I say, you're going to hear from the defense expert, and I play that clip. So it's not coming from me. It's literally coming from them. I think that's very powerful as well. And then you have all your experts explaining why that guy is dead wrong.
Let's move on to the direct of your plaintiff. And what are your pointers, your best practices on the plaintiff direct? Because that's a pretty key part of every injury case.
Yeah. So generally speaking, I try to make it as quick as possible, meaning that I don't want to have my client sitting on the stand for a full day going through every single medical record and every single visit. Generally speaking, I don't think the actual plaintiff is going to be your best witness. They're usually super nervous. I think the jurors definitely has a certain feeling towards the plaintiff that is not always so positive right out of the gate. So I don't think the actual plaintiff is always going to be your best witness. So I like to get them in and out as quick as I can. But I definitely touch about, again, the most important things, which generally is how has this changed their quality of life? What were their hobbies, the things that they enjoyed doing beforehand? Can they still do them? But what does it mean, like, you know, the next day if they're doing those types of like heavy lifting type of things, the medical expenses, the actual device in them, again, a fusion or a spinal cord stimulator, for example, having a metal object in their body for the rest of their life. What does that mean to them? Having a spinal cord stimulator in their body, these like wires that go up their back with this battery, what that means to them, I think is really important so the jury can feel how they kind of feel on a daily basis. And if there's a liability dispute, then your plaintiff is going to be on describing the collision a little bit longer.
Just to give us some idea, the verdict, that your $35 million spinal cord stimulator verdict, how long was your plaintiff testifying for in that case?
I would estimate an hour and a half, which was both direct and cross. So my direct was probably 30 minutes, maybe 40 minutes. And then the defense probably spent like an hour on cross with him.
You know, there's a train of thought that it's a good idea to have your plaintiff testify in front of your focus group and get cross-examined just so they can feel what it's like to be in front of people, because people get nervous talking in front of people, especially when they got so much on the line. Do you ever practice sessions with your plaintiff in front of a group of strangers so they can kind of hopefully get a little more comfortable and then have somebody cross them so they can understand what it's like to feel like to being attacked without having to attack back?
So I have done that. Do I do it all the time? No, I don't. And it's a great idea, but sometimes it's just a circumstance of like time to organize that and to work it out. I wish every part of litigation, we sometimes wish we had more time because there's, again, so much going on when you're preparing for a trial. But it's a great idea. And if you have the time, I highly recommend it for sure. Because I've done it and you can definitely see the positivity it brings to the case for sure.
Right, because, you know, the person's more comfortable. If they're more comfortable, they're going to connect better, right? Nobody connects well, they're all jittery and nervous, whether a plaintiff or a lawyer. And let's talk about before and after witness.
But sometimes I work that into, like, even in my closing, like the jitteriness and the nervousness, it makes them genuine human beings, I think, also, when they're nervous and jittery and maybe don't even say the right thing and make a mistake. Everybody's always worried, God forbid your client makes a mistake on the stand. It's like, no, at the end of the day, I'm like, he's human. Like they want him to memorize, the defense wants him to memorize 3 years of medical records and know exactly what he said to a doctor on every single date. Like that's ridiculous. look what he's going through. So of course he's going to be nervous. And of course he can't express himself in front of a bunch of strangers like you. He knows that at the end of the day, you are going to be deciding his fate, right? 12 strangers are going to decide his fate. So of course he's going to be nervous in front of you. So that I usually play that into my closing. And that's why, again, I go say like the friends and family witnesses who are a little bit less nervous are the most important ones, because they're going to be able to describe how significant of an impact it's been on a, you know, the person's daily life.
So talk about this before and after witnesses, because I think a real dialed in structure is how long you've known him for, the extent of your relationship. Did you know him before the injury, the crash? Yes. And how, what changes have you seen in them between the person you used to know and today? You know, I consider that to be like a real simple, direct, but what would you add to that, or I guess clarify things that you do differently from that structure?
Yeah. So usually, you know, again, the jury's already heard the defense's opening statements, right? And usually I already am referencing what the defense experts are saying. So they're like, oh, it's all pre-existing. So I'm like, wait, okay. So you've known Mr. Johnson, the plaintiff, for 20 years, right? So you've known him for 15 years before our collision, right? So the defense is suggesting that it's all pre-existing and he's had all these issues before this crash. Is that true? No. Well, can you tell us about that? And that would be like, he was great. He loved fishing, horseback riding, and never heard of him complain about pain ever in his life before. All right, now tell us your experience with him after the crash. Well, you know, our plaintiff was a completely different person, both emotionally, psychologically, and physically. And then usually I give a couple, ask them to give us an example of how they were, give us a time where you can, that you experienced him, how he was after the crash. And they'll tell us like, yeah, we talked about the surgery and he broke down crying, just the thought that he had to get surgery or, you know, something like that. You know, every witness has, you know, their different story, but I really use them to really display what this person was like before the crash, what type of person they were also, and then really knocking the defense's case down a little bit, because some of those arguments that they make, I sometimes think are really silly.
Well, it's important the jury thinks they're silly too, I guess, because our opinions are interesting, but irrelevant at the end of the day. It's only the juror's opinion that matters, I've heard.
Yep, exactly, exactly.
Actually, before we talk about Cross, let me ask you, I know that you're a pretty diligent student of this game, because I remember you came to TLU in Vegas in 2021 and 2022, and I was really impressed the fact that, like, you know, I remember, like, all, you know, with me, like, especially like Mitnick was speaking 2021, you're there the whole time. You're like, I got pages and pages of notes, which I was like, wow, I didn't know you were such a student of the game, because, you know, you just don't know how serious people are. So tell us the kind of things that you constantly do on a regular basis to try to get better and improve your craft.
Sure. So I think with all things in life, you're always trying to get better. So I read a ton. I read a ton of trial transcripts from the best people out there. I have all the books, if you can see back here. So I've got all Keith Mitnick's books and pretty much everybody else's books that have written about trial strategy. You have to have those. If you're a plaintiff's attorney and haven't read all the trial books out there, you know, that's a huge mistake. Borderline malpractice, as I tell my associates. So that's like a requirement. If you want to be an associate, you have to read all the major trial books out there. The CVN is a great tool. Obviously, Trial Lawyers University, amazing tool to have. Hearing the best people, what they do, how they evaluate cases, how they strategize as to what they're going to say in front of a jury, there's no better tool than that. So going to conferences, and I generally think to train your mind is not just listening to them, but writing down the thoughts too. So that's why I'm a big time writer of notes, because that's how at least I learn, is the more I write, the more I'll remember things. So even when I'm reading, I like to write down things that I think are really important. If you look at all my books, they're like highlighted with like sticky notes and tabs. Because I think if you just generally read and not actually write after or do something after, I think it's harder to remember. So I'm a big fan of that. Again, anytime you can hear from one of the greatest people out there do something, that's an opportunity to learn and grow. So why the heck would you not?
So let's move on to cross-examination. Cross-examination of experts. Give us your approach and philosophy.
It's really, you know, big part of it is pointing out the biases. Because a lot of these experts, I think, do have some major biases. working for the defense 100% of the time, you got to wonder, well, what's his opinions going to be out of the gate? Did he already have conclusions before he even started reading anything? Is he getting paid millions and millions of dollars by the defense team? That's kind of important to know. And I think the jury wants to know that. So those are obviously key things, figuring out what records they never reviewed. It's remarkable to see how many cases there are where the defense just like didn't send certain records to their expert. Don't know why they do that, but it for some reason comes up all the time and it's hilarious. And you can use it to your advantage, things like that. And then of course, again, I get a lot of, like I said earlier, a lot of transcripts of the defense experts. So I'm reaching out to all my friends, all the listservs out there, who has recently deposed this person, who has seen this expert in trial, because it's inevitable that, oh, look, this expert said one thing on one case and then testified exactly the opposite in another case or something.
That happens?
That, can you believe it? I mean, so that's always fun to deal with. Or they say the same thing on every single case consistently that is ridiculous. Like our defense biomechanic friends out there, you can't injure your back in a rear end collision. It's like, wait, why not? You've worked on 1,000 cases and all those cases, there's an allegation of a back injury from a rear end collision. So are you sure you can't injure your back in a rear end collision? It's like, you know, funny things like that.
Funny things like that, those defense experts, huh? And like recross. So give us your insights on, you know, after the defense does a direct, you do your cross. Now they do a redirect, of course, just like you did, try to point out your best points. So what's your objective on recross?
On recross, just again, hit them with a 2 or 3 really inconsistent things that I think that they're trying to trick the jury on. So I don't spend too much time on recross, but like, for example, if they're trying to be like, oh, everything in the MRI is pre-existing, because, you know, that's a classic one, right? It's like, wait, I want to point out, like, there was no MRI before this crash, right? So you keep saying that everything on the MRI would be on the MRI from before, right? If there was an MRI before, it would look exactly the same. But sir, the evidence shows there was no MRI before because my client didn't need an MRI before. There's no doctor that suggested my client needed an MRI before this crash. It was only after this collision when he needed that MRI, right? And that usually is a big point, is because they really try to, what I think is, trick the jury in making them think like, oh, this is all pre-existing, but yet there's no documents or evidence to support there was an injury before the collision. Again, that's one example. You know, depending on the expert, depending on the facts of the case, there's so many different ways to play that.
All right, now let's move on to closing argument, Mr. Teller. Closing argument. How important do you think that is to get your verdict? Because I know everybody says voir dire and opening, that's when it's all set. And like, yet, this is our last word.
I generally think everything's equally important. I hope I'm already winning the case at this point, going into closing. I probably have identified who I think the jurors are that are good for me, who I think the jurors are bad for me. In California, you need 9 out of 12, right? So I'm trying to figure out who are my 9. You know, hopefully I have more than 9, but who are my 9? So it's really, I need to invigorate those people, or at least I'm trying to find like 2 or 3 people that are really with me so that when they're in the back talking about it, those 2 or 3 people are really going to push for our side and push for our client. So, you know, I walk through the evidence, of course, you know, not every single piece, but again, the big points. I need to remind them, again, what the verdict form is going to look like. I always have a copy of the verdict form so that they can see and go through each issue. Again, most of the lines are going to be about damages, right? Yeah, you'll have negligence and substantial factor, but then it's past medical expenses, future medical expenses. If there's a loss of earnings, there could be past and future for that. And then non-economics, past and future for those. So I really want to make sure I get the jury writing down numbers for those lines that they're going to be writing down in the back in the jury room. So sometimes literally, if I don't see jurors writing down, I say, hey, if you're going to write anything down, this is when you need to start writing because this is going to be on the verdict form. So sometimes I'll say that and ask them to write down numbers. And yeah, then I'll explain why I believe, you know, the numbers, the evidence is supported by the numbers, of course. I use a bunch of analogies usually. Sometimes they're similar analogies that I used in voir dire in terms of appraising things like artwork or appraising the value of a house or a building or what basketball players make. Usually I've already talked about that in voir dire, so I now bring it back up in closing and then put it all together, you know, what the value is and ask them to, those are the numbers that they should put. And then obviously, again, if it's a liability case, you've got to spend time on the liability part of the case too, because you don't want them to be totally on your side in terms of damages, but lose on the first question, is the defendant negligence? And the answer is no, that's never a good thing. So make sure you hit negligence or substantial factor. I've heard stories where people have lost on substantial factor because, you know, they hit everything else and forgot about that and they lose on that question. It's like, oh man, you didn't even get to the numbers on the verdict form because you lost on the second question.
So substantial factor, how do you talk about substantial factor? Because that's always one that people struggle with because it's such an abstract concept.
Yeah, I just hit it like, you know, generally speaking, hey, there was no injury. He was not seeing any doctors before this crash. Crash happens. He's seeing all these doctors, hundreds of appointments. Is it the crash that has something to do with his injury? Probably. If you think, again, it's more likely true than not. All I need you to say is 51%, or really it's 50.1%. If it's more likely true than not that it was the crash that did anything to him, you have, the law says you have to say yes to that question. You guys all told me in voir dire you would follow the law when we went over this. I think the evidence is overwhelming. It's probably beyond a reasonable doubt, but I only need to get you more likely true than not true. You can't possibly tell me, you know, it's not 51% given he's got like no or almost no treatment before, then this crash occurs, then he's seeing hundreds of doctors. I'm very practical about it. I don't waste time on like the words because yeah, the substantial factor jury instruction in California is like sometimes a little bit too wordy for people. So I'm very just like practical about it.
And you talked about metaphors for, you know, value and stuff, I think. In your case where you got your $35 million verdict, how did you articulate the value? Because that's, you know, you can't do a per diem. Oh, you're going to pay him, you know, $50,000. You know what I mean? So how did you articulate the value of the losses to your client in that particular case?
So I do a combination of both. I usually do have some type of per diem argument within the closing because I want to give those jurors that like that type of analogy to use that. Meaning there's going to be some jurors that hate the per diem argument and there's going to be that some that like it. There's going to be some people that hate comparing the injuries to an $80 million painting. And there's going to be some people that like that, right? So I kind of want to hit everybody to try to make sure I connect with as many jurors as possible. So in that case, it also happened to be that it was a judge who didn't let me talk about the exact figures in opening and voir dire. And it also happened to be a judge that wouldn't let me do any analogies, like wouldn't let me talk about airplanes or paintings or basketball players, unless there was evidence of it during the trial. So that's also like a new, again, thing that you got to know out of the gate is how your judge handles things like closing arguments. So usually, again, talk to fellow trial attorneys, find out about your judges. Usually I ask the judge out of the gate before we get started, like, do you have any specific rules about voir dire, opening or closing? So, you know, so I knew about that out of the gate. So one thing that actually was important to my client that really affected him is his ability to read, reading books, reading the newspaper, reading magazines. So given that I now had testimony about reading books, newspapers, and magazines, I was allowed to use an analogy of what people have heard is called like the newspaper analogy of, you know, there's an ad in a newspaper. And so I use that analogy to help.
Like the job description, like here's the job.
Yep.
This is what it's going to pay. Do you take it?
Exactly.
Only because your client said he liked to read the newspaper. Were you able to use that analogy?
Yeah, literally. It was wild. The judge wouldn't let me do a whole bunch of these other things that I've done on other cases and I've seen other people do in other cases. So, yeah.
So what did you say though? I you just didn't answer my question, Taylor. I'm like, what did, so you couldn't say much about, so how did you get that? articulate the value and convince these people that your guy's spinal cord stimulator and back surgery was a $35 million hit.
So again, so through the per diem model, I think the loss of enjoyment of life is worth $100 an hour. The physical pain is worth $50 an hour. The humiliation is worth $50 an hour. And all the other things, fear, anxiety, inconvenience, that's worth $25 an hour. So if you add those all up, that equaled to, I think, like $9 million for the past. And then for the future, he was going to live another 8 years, I believe, 8 or 9 years. So I said, you have to at least double that, given he's going to be living double the time. And he's got, again, he's dealing with this horrible pain. He's going to have metal in his body for the rest of his life. Spinal cord stimulator. He's basically like a human robot now with these wires and a battery in him. So that's worth at least double. So the future has to be at least $18 to $20 million for the future non-economics. And then, you know, again, that, as you described, the newspaper analogy is like he would rather have his health and his family and not have to deal with any of this rather than the money. He would never take that job opportunity for the $20 million or $30 million. He'd much rather have his quality of life and his job and his experiences, because that's what life is all about, is the experiences and your interactions with your family and your friends. All those things that he's lost out on in life, you know, he'd much rather have that back. So when we talk about being appraisers, what the value is of losing out on all those things, yeah, that's my evaluation. You can go higher if you want. You can go lower if you want. But that's what we believe the evidence shows.
Let's talk about rebuttal now. Your rebuttal, do you plan that out ahead of time? You know what the defense is going to say. I mean, do you think it through, or is it completely extemporaneous after the defense is down?
It's a little bit of both. The one thing that I don't plan, because I don't know what's going to happen, is what the defense is going to skip out on. So that's something I'm really paying attention to, and I'm writing that little note to myself. They skipped out on a major fact of the case. I'm for sure bringing that up in rebuttal. They totally chose not to discuss X. Think about that. Why didn't they? So like, let's just say, I don't know if it's whether it's the surgery report or it's like the MRI, right? Their whole case is pre-existing, but they did not bring up the MRI at all to you in their 2 hours they were talking to you. They didn't bring up the MRI once. Their experts told you that the MRI is so important, yet the defense attorney chose to leave that out of their presentation. Ask yourself why that is. So that's something that I'm not like preparing, because I don't know what they're going to leave out, but there's usually something really important, whether it's an MRI, whether it's every doctor found that there was radiculopathy. That's usually, they don't want to tell the juror that every doctor said that there was radiculopathy, right? That's a big one that they usually leave out. Every case is a little bit different, of course. Usually there's something on liability that they, again, leave out that's super, super important. And then the things I do kind of prepare is I'm ready to discuss the value of damages that they put on. So I don't know exactly how much they're going to tell the jury, but it's usually something super low, right? So they're like, we think, based on all that, we think the damages are worth $25,000. So if you're going to give the juror, if you're going to give the plaintiff anything, give him $25,000, maximum $100,000, right? Some super low number. I'm ready to calculate out what that means in terms of the future. So that's usually, again, because I usually do some type of per diem, I then throw that back at them. I say, according to the defense, my client's, you know, value of life and everything he's lost is only worth 8 cents per hour. I mean, is that reasonable? You know, he went on and on about being reasonable, right? He loved using the word, you have to be reasonable and it's not a lottery and all this stuff that the defense just said. He just said, having metal in your spine for the rest of your life is worth a mere 8 cents.
In your $35 million verdict, what did the defense argue? Since it was admitted liability, what they argued the number should be?
It was probably something like that, like $25,000 or $50,000. It was something super small. It was also a case where it was an open policy issue. This is why I love open policy issues, is because the insurance company usually tells them, hey, you defense counsel, you can't suggest a number over the policy limit, because then that's basically an admission that it's an open policy case. The values of the case is worth more than the policy limits. So usually the defense attorney is handcuffed into because, you know, unfortunately, a lot of defense attorneys care more about the insurance company than their actual client. That's a whole separate conversation we can have another time. But usually they're going to ask for a number under the insurance policy limits. And if it's a small policy, the number is going to be super small and super unreasonable. And I think that ends up making the jury really upset with the defense with how unreasonable their numbers are.
Makes sense. So that was really what I want to talk to you about as the trial goes, Mr. Teller. But now we have to move to the next most important thing to talk about, and that is TLU Huntington Beach, June 5th through 8th. Because now with these recent verdicts, you've actually earned your place on a stage. I know that's exciting. This is big. This isn't CALA. This isn't COC. You know, all of your connections and your networks aren't going to get you anywhere here at Travelers University, Mr. Teller. This is a merit-based operation. So the time that you have on the stage in Huntington Beach, what do you want to communicate to the people who, you know, they got Brian Pan speaking, Nick Raleigh, Keith Mitnick, but on that fourth track is John Teller. And they show up to see you because these other people are like, they're so far ahead of us. It's like I have trouble connecting with them. But you're only maybe a couple years ahead of most of these folks, you know, and you had to do this on your own. You're somewhat self-made because you got the biggest verdict at your firm, right? Am I correct?
I believe so.
I think so. All right. So, John, June 5th through 8th in Huntington Beach at the Paseo Hotel, we're going to be doing Trial Lawyers University. And so you're going to be presenting there. So what is it that you want to share with the people that come to your presentation? What do you want them to walk away with?
So we're going to be going through the cross-examination of defense medical experts, how to really point out all the kind of nonsense that they are telling the jury to get the jury on your side at that moment, pissed off at the defense. That's, you know, real practical tips as to how to properly cross-examine those defense medical experts.
Oh, that'd be great. Well, John, thanks for being here with our new format on trial. And we look forward to your webinar. So we're going to be in touch on that because we need to do a couple webinars on these verdicts so that way you can reflect on them, break down what you actually did piece by piece, and other people can learn from it and model their cases after it. So that needs to be done.
Let's do it.
We need those on the schedule for, you know, February, March, once your trial calendar clears up a little bit. Sound good?
Sounds good. It was a lot of fun. Great to see you again.
All right. Thanks for visiting, John.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University. Produced and powered by LawPods.